Good morning. Aloha kaka hiaka. This is Maka'ala and this is Pilikia Opono. 7 a.m. sharp if you don't count all the important information that we pass on. One of the things that we need to say right now. Thank you, Pat Durkin, from Lifeguard Association. The high surf warning for Kauai was island-wide. It was due to extend to 6 a.m. this morning. I suspect it's been extended, but I didn't see that yet. That means several things for us here, folks. It means tourists, stay out of the water, unless you're right next to a lifeguard. It also means that jet skis in Hanalei, you can play. High surf warning is the standard. And you can be in the bay. Any other time, you cannot be in the bay. So welcome to the bay today. I also want to mention Mauna Kea Trask is with me on this program, and he will be joining us in just a second. I first need to say this. Where in this world, on this island, in this place, would you ever have a show or program like this? It's not possible. It's not possible because we have opinions and we have facts and we have information and we have thoughts and we have dreams and we have hopes. And that's just not what commercial radio is about. That is what community radio is all about. And we talked on Monday quite extensively about the advantage of having community radio when we have an incident, is what I'm calling the latest tsunami exercise. It was a very, very serious situation, and I don't want people to think that everyone was stupid and didn't call it right. It was a wave, and it was headed our way, and we needed to respond. Whether or not it was big enough to cause trouble when it got to us is another matter altogether. But one thing is for certain, it provided us all with the opportunity to get our act together and get out of harm's way if we could. It forced us to do the things that we should be doing anyway. But it also reminded us that as our larger government entity, that thing they call the feds, has yanked the funding from public broadcasting, our little radio station on the North Shore of Kauai played a major role in providing accurate information. Not that rumor stuff, not that government mush, but accurate information about the status of the traffic and where you should go and how you should get there. If they knew, and if they didn't know, they said they didn't know. And if they didn't know, they tried to find out and then tell you. So that's a different approach to broadcasting. And that's why KKCR is so critical to our community. This is our fundraising period, and we ask you to please contribute to the support of KKCR. The government funding that was erased, taken back, taken away, equaled 20% of the entire budget of KKCR. And we need to make that up because we weren't kidding. It wasn't money we were all putting in our pockets because we're all volunteers. It is money that it takes to run this show, to run this building, to run the power, to pay the couple of people who are experts in things like towers and antennas and stuff like that. So that is to the tune of $83,000, and that is what we're trying to raise. So if you enjoy this program and other programs, because there's such a wide variety, please, now's the time to show that support and go to kkcr.org and hit the donate button. I've taken to calling it the donut button. I know it's not that, but please hit the donate button, whatever you can, and every little bit counts. It's absolutely amazing how it adds up. So thank you for listening to that pitch, and good morning, Mauna. How are you?
Hey, aloha. Good morning. Doing well.
Good.
Need that money.
Good. Good. Did you do your homework?
I did.
I scared him to death yesterday. I called him and I said, Mauna, the show's tomorrow. Ah! Thought it was next week. Ah! But because Mauna Kea is already at least half prepared. I'm sure it wasn't that big a trick. But we're in kind of a series, so it was important that we at least get somewhat coordinated. And as usual, the conversation between Mauna Kea Trask and Maka'ala goes off the rails fairly quickly. But we are going to talk about Mary Kavena Pukui. And if you've lived in Hawaii or know about Hawaii, you know that name. You know that name because she did so much amazing work for the Hawaiian language and for our understanding of Hawaiian history, the Hawaiian mentality. And we've had a series of, this will be the third show, of scholars and historians, and I call them guides, people who know stuff and share stuff articulately and help us understand how to live in this place. Because living in this place is different. It is. It's different. And so, good morning to Mary Kavena Pukui. What do we want folks to know about her?
Oh, she's the best, man. Mary Kavena Pukui. I think, you know, and as we start, I want to give a special acknowledgement and aloha to her family, the Suganumas, who are carrying on her legacy. So you got Pele Hunuamea Suganuma and La'akea Suganuma. I do think that there are, Ohana have special, you know, mana in them, and it is carried on through that Ohana in the family. And so, like Mary Kavena Pukui, as we'll learn, she learned from her kupuna that there are, her descendants are carrying on the good work that she did and that was done before her, and then I'm sure we'll keep on going. So I don't want to take their mana from them. This is their, you know, this is their grandmother and mother and stuff. So I just want to say that.
And their legacy, and their kuleana.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're just kind of putting it out there because of our vast audience.
Starting with the name. Or at least the two people that run up to us in Big Safe and say,
oh, yeah,
that was good stuff. Why didn't you? What I get is, that was good. I really enjoyed it. It's really early, yeah? I'm like, yeah, it's early, 7 a.m. And then they'll say,
hey, get up!
Yeah. and then they'll say something about, why didn't you say? why don't you do? Hey, brah, you can call in 808-826-7771 and say it on the air, or you can email the general manager, Annie, @gm@kkcr.org with your suggestions. We do appreciate them. So thank you for that. Okay, sorry, yeah. Mauna.
No, go. So starting with her, Mary Kavena Mary Kavena Ula Okalani Hiiaka Ikapolio Pele Nalele Hua Apele Wigin Pukui.
Wow.
Born April 20, 1895. Passed away May 21st, 1986, 91 years old. Her father was Nathaniel Wigan from Salem, Massachusetts. Her mother was Mary Pa'ahana Kanaka'ole of Kau. And her maternal grandmother, right, obviously, Nali'i Po'ai Moku, also from Kau. Her grandmother was a Kahuna La'au La'pa'au. For those of you who don't know what that is, that's like a Hawaiian medical, that's a Hawaiian doctor. Herbal medicine and stuff, prayers, and also a kahuna palekeiki, a midwife, and a hula dancer in Queen Emma's court. So her grandmother delivered her as a midwife and then asked her parents if she could hanai her in the traditional way and raise her. So in Hawaiian culture, the firstborn keiki was traditionally given to the grandparents to raise. And I guess it's still kind of like that in many circumstances. But so that's what she did, and she grew up in Kau, inseparable from her tutu, who taught her everything. I mean, and if you read around, it was very intentional. the grandmother, Maliipo'ai Moku, wanted to give her granddaughter, who they called Kavena, raised her in that old way, because at that time it was disappearing, or you know, it was clear that I was on that path. So and I think that's very important when you talk about her place in Hawaiian scholarship and intellectualism and stuff, because she really was the only one, I think, who straddled the old ways and the modern ways in the 20th century. And she has, I think, what distinguishes her from Malo and Kamakau is her knowledge, her breadth of knowledge. It was based on, a lot of it was science, because as she got older, she worked at Bishop Museum, she worked with anthropologists, she was an expert in what she knew, fluent in Hawaiian, she knew the Hawaiian culture. Not formally degreed, I don't think, after high school. I don't think she graduated from college. She has honorary doctorates, multiple, but I don't think she got a degree herself, traditionally. So anyway, learned all the old stuff, and Kamakau and Malo did not know the modern ways, right? They were educated in the missionary sense, which is nothing wrong with that. It's what it was at the time. Mary Kavena Pukui was around science. And it really shows in her perspective, in her writings. She describes Hawaiians and their culture in such a way where it's clear that it wasn't, and she says this, it wasn't like a woo-woo, magical, mystical thing. These people were hardcore observationists. You know, everyone talks about kino now, kilo nowadays. And they really, the way she describes it, it's obvious it was much more than just recreational viewing. Like, these people had been looking at these islands and nature for 1,000 years, and their culture was built around that. It was what worked. So anyway, graduated from the Hawaiian Mission Academy in her 20s, which is equivalent to high school, I think, at the time, and worked Bishop Museum 1938 to 1961 as an ethnological assistant and translator. Worked with anthropologists and scientists from all over the world. And they all came to her because she was pretty much one of the only ones that knew was fluent in Hawaiian at the time and could speak at that level with those people that they had access to. So she was really everything rolled into one. And taught at Punahou, as you know. and like you said, she was prolific in writing. She started collecting sayings, poetical sayings and stories and folk tales at 15 years old, and throughout her whole life just diligently acquired all this knowledge. And she would go around getting mana'o from older Hawaiians throughout the Big Island in Hawaii. So to her credit, she has, I mean, the Hawaiian Dictionary, Place Names of Hawaii, Nana'ike Kumu Volumes 1 and 2, Polynesian Family Systems of Ka'u, Olelo no Eau, I mean, all the books. If you look, it's Pukui and Elbert, Pukui and Handy, Pukui and somebody, but all Pukui. And she's also credited with making the Hawaiian Renaissance possible in the 1970s, because she was the living bridge between the old ways and the later 20th century, when Haunani Ke, Mililani, Liko Martin, you know, John Osorio, the Uncle gang, Walter, them, the they gang. All took it the next level.
Yeah. Yeah. But the key to me, for me, was that not only was she a fluent speaker, but she could read it as well. She really was fluent in all aspects, and therefore if a modern day or current in her time scientist or educator needed something, she could find it. She could find it in the written word if they'd been long gone. And she could point to it. When she was at Bishop Museum, not my memory particularly, but my memory of knowledge was that you'd go to her and she was one of those, you know, she certainly was not a librarian, but I'm going to use this comparison because she knew exactly where to get what she needed or what they were looking for, what was required for the work they were doing. So she might not have had it all in her brain, but she knew exactly where to find it. And she did it with, you know, there's lots of videos of her. Even now, if you Google her or if you go to YouTube or whatever, there's a lot of record of her visually and auditorially. And there was a certain sense of grace. You know, there was a certain sense of no ego involved. Just, you know, these are the things that our people know. These are important to now. These are important to the future. And it's interesting that you mentioned Kilo, because I flew back from Honolulu on Sunday, and there was a Hawaiian brata sitting in the aisle across from me. And he and I were both really looking at the ocean, because the ocean was reflecting the energy and the stuff that was happening atmospherically as Kiko passed us by. And there were all the current lines and all the you know, it almost looked like flotsam and jetsam, you know, those lines of stuff in the water. But you don't see that any other time. It was very different. And he and I both had our noses glued to the window, because it just looks so different. A little bit foreboding, I will say. We glanced at each other once in a while and went, whoa, that looks like something's coming. And then we flew in Konas. We flew in, you know, what we call in Lihue backwards, and landed with a thud. And I thought to myself, gosh, so many of the people on this plane right now have no idea how different that is and why they do that. There were two young, there's always victims sitting next to me in airplanes. There was two young women sitting next to me, and one of them was filming, and I said, keep filming, because this is unusual. It's not rare, but it's unusual. And they wanted to know why. So those are the kinds of things that Mary Kavena Puku'i would have loved, right? She would have loved that opportunity to say to a young person, look, really look, and pay attention and think about what you're seeing, not just for the experience of it or the joy of it, but really look. Kilo is really, really look. And when you really look, the answers are there because of people like her. Information is available because of people like her. Because she did not only know where to go to find stuff, but she kept stuff kind of in order, yeah, at Bishop. Bishop had a way of turning into chaos once in a while. And she, in my high school years, I remember people thumbing through stuff and digging through files and, you know, looking for boxes. And I think, oh, gosh, is this a system? But she was orderly, yeah, with grace and order, looking
for a reason. And again, I've never met her. I think I was like 7 when she passed away or something, but... you're right. I mean, going back to her, she was a very humble scholar. She writes, and you know, we always talk about Olelo Noʻeau and Nana Ike Kumu, because they're just such large works, place names. I mean, the Hawaiian Dictionary, everyone knows these books, whether you know them or not. I mean, she's there. She's always there. But one of my favorite books, it has been Polynesian Family Systems of Kaʻu. Because she presents, you know, the place and culture that she was raised in, and she calls it Polynesian family systems, right? She doesn't say Hawaiian, and I think there's reasons for that, and her perspective is so different than what, you know, the narratives that we're presented with today and that we've grown up with, and it's cutting. And you can, and the best thing about her, what I love about her and Malo and Kamakawa, is they're beyond reproach. You can't argue with them. You can't even really disagree with them. I mean, what are you going to do, right? So to hear her when she says, we'll provide the links to this book. It's free on ulukau.org. It's PDF. She talks about to ask what either author, it's written, co-written by her and E.S. Craig Hill-Handy, to ask what either author believes is idle. For sake of objectivity, we always seek to keep our own personal beliefs out of the way, insofar as possible. I mean, how often do you hear that nowadays? Nowadays, always somebody, usually on social media, telling you what it is because of what they say. She was very removed, even though she could speak authoritatively about everything. She had that scientific, humble scholar, real scholar approach to these things. And yeah, like you said, when she writes about the Hawaiian relationship with nature, and she describes it as, you know, the whole entire nature being everything, world, universe, cosmology, all that. She says none of these observations were idle. She says, you know, you wouldn't describe Native Hawaiians and their relationship to things as, you know, magical and mystical. It was not religious. It was real. And so she says, I'm flipping through it right now.
Okay. And it was not entertainment. So it was not, I didn't learn much in school, but I did learn that, for her, it was not entertainment. And Hawaiians they certainly did things that entertained them. They had fun. There's no doubt about that. But her work was not entertainment. And her description of family life in Kau, which, by the way, is where my husband's family is from, everything was intentional. Even having fun was intentional. The meals were chosen and prepared intentionally. It wasn't just what was left over. The task was intentional. And when when Tutu said she was ono for something, the gathering or the hunting or the fishing was intentional. They didn't just go get whatever had. They did not. They went intentionally. And I was looking at a short video yesterday on YouTube describing life on the North Shore of Kauai, and that one of the statements they made was, we did hukilau every day. Well, that seems odd to me. I don't know why you would do that. I'm not doubting that somebody did, but that seems very odd to me, because that was not how I understood it and how I was taught. I was taught that you knew it was the right time, you knew where the right place was, you kilo, you look, you see, if get, and then you go and you only take what you need, of course, and, you know, we all know that mantra. But it was intentional. You were living intentionally. And I smile when I think of some of the modern day, modern meaning, you know, 21st century, people who are saying, you know, you must acknowledge intent, you must live with intent, you must, you know, strive with intent. Well, duh. You can't just do it for no reason at all. You get no value from it, you know. She was one of the people that could translate that to the Malihini or to the scientists. What fascinates me is how much respect they showed her. Because don't forget, this is the same period of time that Margaret Mead was practicing, right? And
yeah,
Margaret Mead was saying all kinds of stuff. And I know a lot of Native people who went, whoa, man, she was, you know, a little out there, right?
And the Samoans, I mean, they told her a lot of any kind of stuff, right?
Yes, exactly. They believed them because they couldn't, because they weren't fluent, because they weren't of the place, because they didn't understand. Exactly. Exactly. So you kind of have to weed it out. You know, it's really easy. Wouldn't we have fun with her today? you know, telling her totally. Any kind of stuff. I'd be at the head of the line for that. But Mary Kavena Pukui was completely different than that. Completely different because of the academic nature of her personality, of her teaching, and of her work.
And I would say, but it's in a way, though, it wasn't I just want to qualify, it was academic, but in the true Hawaiian sense. And in that way, it was the Hawaiian way.
Yeah.
Like, the Hawaiian way was the academic way. She writes it right here. She goes, "All Hawaiian's oneness with the living aspect of native phenomena, that is, with spirits and gods and other persons as souls, is not correctly described by the word rapport, and certainly not by such words as sympathy, empathy, abnormal, supernormal, or neurotic, mystical, or magical. It is just a part of natural consciousness for a normal Hawaiian." And so, and then she says later, in you gotta read this together, I love this, is that almost certainly there was, breezes, colors, ruffling surfs, all these things, whatever is noted and distinguished as significant has some real specific and definite role in the business of living. It may be utilitarian or aesthetic or psychic. It was something in some way used. Certainly there was an infinite variety of things in forest and sea, meteorological or marine phenomena, which was unnamed because unnoteworthy since there was no use or interest. Living was experience fraught with exact and definite significance. One had a relationship only with what was tangibly a part of one's living. The old Hawaiians had no pure science and did not indulge in art for art's sake. That's exactly what you said. And it's exactly what she was, not because she was an educated, in quotes, like, whatever, Western ways. It was Hawaiian.
It was the way she was brought up. It was because she was brought up by her tutu.
And who taught her all this stuff. And so when you look, and like you said, but my whole life, what the reason why I think that's so interesting to me is because when I was raised and right now, and this is not from my grandfather, my tutu, what I learned from him was different than when I was hearing in the periphery. And I kind of listened more to the periphery when I was a kid, but now I recognize that he really knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, isn't that always the way?
But, and so when you see that, like you and the broad and the airplane, like those currents, they have their reason. And I think you were drawn to that for that reason. And so when you look at things like, you know, you think about it, everything was intentional. You can't plan a hukilau. Hukilaus happen when they happen. The organization it takes, all this stuff.
Thank
surrounded
you.
By, you know, kapu, all this. Like, and we tried. I remember Mayor Carvalho really wanted to do a
hukilau. And I screamed and stomped. Do you remember me? I called. I yelled. I went down to the office. I said, "What are you doing?" he said, "Makala, you got to show up. We're going to do it." I said, "That's not how it's done."
Yeah, but you got to try. I mean, it was like a good community thing, right?
Yeah,
it was,
I suppose.
But we didn't catch any fish.
wrong message. Well, you didn't get much, right?
Yeah, but and so just to contextualize it, when you look at something like that and then you apply it to Hawaiian history, it becomes much more deep and interesting. So, for example, when Kamehameha is on the rise and he talks to his kahuna and they say, "Oh, if you want to take over everything, if you want to unite the islands under your authority, you have to build this heiau to Ku Kaili Moku, Ku who snatches the land. It's got to be big." And then he proceeds to do it. They build Pu'ukohola. And in doing so, they're moving rocks from Pololu, like
miles.
Over 10 miles away.
Yeah.
Pololu's far from Kauai. They move those rocks for however many months or years it takes to do it. And then at the end, he proceeds to steamroll everybody. And, you know, imagine... And so when you think about it, like, wow, Ku is very powerful, and you do it, and you look at it in a very abstract sense. But think about that. If you and everybody in your town, your gang, builds, lifts rocks, walks them for miles every day for a year, years, you're going to be CrossFit Mega Strong after that. Like, you'll be monsters. And who's going to stand in your way? Men, women, children, everybody. I mean, the squats, the legs.
And you're going to protect, and you're going to protect that heyao win pao. You're gonna understand that place. You're gonna be part of that place.
Yeah.
The energy of the verb, the energy of the action of moving that stuff becomes part of you. I'm not getting woo-woo here. It just does, right? You can't possibly participate in something like that. Even just the dynamic of the community focused on one endeavor is huge.
Yeah.
We've
it's
seen
like,
it here.
Like
we see it today with restoration. We see it Ha'ena. We see it Hule'ia. We see it He'eia on Oahu. They're getting ready, by the way, to close that wall. It's going to be what I would call a magical day. And you can't be there, because these days I go there as Kupuna. I don't lift the rocks, but I sit and observe and try to encourage. And even that, you're lifted. I'm lifted. The energy of that force, you know, that's part of it. That's part of it. And today, people would say, "Oh, you know, yeah, you know, woo-woo stuff." But it's not. It's a real thing, right? You're a participant.
No, it's organization.
And you're a participant in life. You're not just an observer. So the observers, it's important, you know, to be kilo, but you have to have knowledge to kilo correctly, to observe correctly, to interpret correctly. And also to have people like her to whom you could go and say, "Hey, I saw this weird line in the ocean yesterday. What is the meaning of that?" And she would tell you. She would know, because she'd been taught that. I'm not sure to whom I would go today, but the brother and I just kind of, it was one of those glances. I didn't know him. He was clearly Hawaiian, but I didn't know him. I'd seen him on other flights, and we just sort of glanced at each other like, "Whoa, you know, that's different. That's weird." And then we could see why. It was because the winds were different. But the comparison as you're talking between her work, her effort, and that of Margaret Mead, for whom I have respect. But a very, very different level of respect. I want to take this moment to say you're listening to KKCR, KAQA, Kilauea, and we're so happy that you are. This is Pilikia Opono. I always forget to do this half-hour thing. I'm not even right on today. I get the clock right in my face, folks, by the way. It's not like I don't have the clue. And we appreciate that you're listening, and you can call. This is not... We're not scared. We're not scared your calls. It's 808-826-7771. And Mauna Kea will post the sources of anything that he cites or quotes on the website. And you just look under archives and look under Pilikia Opono, and they are there and they stay there. Or you can certainly search on your own. I think many of us have all these books in our homes, right? In our offices. I certainly have. I have a couple of raggedy copies of Olelo No'eau. I finally said, "You know, you deserve a nice, pretty, clean copy." So I got a nice, pretty, clean
copy. Whoa, the red hardcover. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty raggedy. Because when you're young and you're searching for something, you're searching fast, right? Racing through the book, looking, "Where was that? What did I need that?" So the thing that she talked about, the family structure and so forth in Kau, was because that's what she knew. She wasn't talking about something she didn't know or hadn't been to or didn't completely understand. She did understand. And she had the knowledge that her tutu gave her, but also just daily life, yeah? And practical stuff. Why does this work like that? Why does that work like this? Kind of, you know, notion. There's so many pieces of it that seem to be mystical. But if you shred them, if you take them apart, they're not. They're part of the world. They're part of life. They're just
yeah,
unusual.
Go ahead.
Poor Mauna. Poor Mauna. I don't know whatever he thinks he's going to say on this show, but have you met me? Because he thinks we have a plan, and then Makala wakes up and goes, oh wait, there's this. Oh no. And then I, on my drive to the studio, it's really interesting. I'm listening to this audiobook, The Plover. It's a great book, folks. I totally recommend it. It's written really, really, really well. And, you know, our plover are back. Our kulea are back. Intentionally. Kilo them. Watch them. Pay attention to them. They are territorial. There's one in that part of the yard, one in another part of the yard. Their whole lives are intentional. When they leave here, they go to Nome, Alaska. They don't go to, you know, another part of Alaska. They go to Nome. And they all go together. And I paint this picture from my students of somebody gave them walkie-talkies. Because on April 25th, they all hooey up. They all gather on some promontory, cliff of some sort, highland. And then they go. And there's always a straggler or two, but they go. They all go. They come from all over and they all go one time, one day, together. And these are not big gliding albatrosses. These are birds with little wings. They got to flap, 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 flap the whole way. They don't stop. They don't rest. They don't eat. They go. Can you imagine? So if you know that, what else? Or if you don't know that, what else don't you know? If you do know that, what else do you know, right? The craft, the experience, the import of true observation. And how that applies to you and to your life and what you want to get out of it, yeah? She was really good at that. Mary Kavena Pukui, to me, was very, very good at telling the story of what life could be like if we just paid attention. Just pay attention.
Yeah.
Mauna's lost again. Mauna's
I don't
going,
know
this
where
is
we
not-
are right now. But like you said, I feel like one. Yeah, I feel like one of Auntie Kalihua's dogs. Like, I just want to bite. I want to talk, say something. But talking about, I have to get this off my brain or it's going to.
Okay, go. It's going to burn a hole. I know. Go ahead.
But I think why I want the main thing. I want to promote today is Polynesian Family System of Kau.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's really commonly looked at. It's a bigger book. And, you know, Olelo Naiao is really easy. It's like 12 to 1400 sayings, real digestible. It's a dictionary, of course. You just use it as a dictionary. But Polynesian Family System of Kau is so interesting because it's actually I got my bachelor's in science and anthropology, and so it's actually an ethnographic study, which is like usually you get anthropologists go into another culture like Margaret Mead did, and they go, hi, I'm very smart, smarter than you guys, and I'm going to tell me everything about your life and culture. Tell me all your secrets. I'm going to write it up and let people back home read it. And so a lot of in retrospect, people discover that, a lot of these Samoans are just, they are people. They're not constructs. And they just told her some accurate stuff, some inaccurate stuff. They told her to beat it. But Mary Kavena Pukui, in her book, she, like you said, she told what she knew. And what she knew and what she presented is so different than what is commonly told. And I think that it's so good to understand that because, like, she doesn't say Hawaiian family systems. She says Polynesian family systems. Mm-hmm. She doesn't talk for all the islands. She says of Kau. Because when you read it, you understand, and she tells you, Kau people were different. They were not Hilo people. They were not Kona people. They were not Kauai people. They were Kau people. And you get further into it, and you realize that Hawaii, as a free nation. It wasn't a nation of people. It was like Europe before secularization, right? It was before nationalism. It was a bunch of kingdoms, entirely separate. And they had different gods. They had different practices. They had different everythings, different words for things. It wasn't one language. They were Polynesians, right? Because they would not all call themselves Hawaiian pre-unification of the Crimea. And the really interesting thing about it, and this is on page 232 and 233, she talks about, and I'm just going to, I've quoted enough, and you know, from the book verbatim, you can read it, but in essence, she describes, you know, when Captain Cook first sailed by Kau in the late 1700s, he described it as a vibrant, active place, plenty of people. A couple decades later, like 1830s, 1840s, it's destitute. There's nothing there. And so she kind of ruminates about how did that happen. When Kau was so remote, especially back then, it had less contact with Malihini and the Westerners than Lahaina at the time, than Honolulu at the time. And she says, well, the reason why, we lost our spirit. We lost who we were, mm-hmm. not at contact, but when Kamehameha unified. When he came in and conquered us, he took away our, you know, individuality, our society. And she saw it as a more potent cause of the dissolution of society in Kau than foreign contact. And then think about that. When nowadays do you hear that the unification of the kingdom under Kamehameha had a more detrimental effect to a Hawaiian community than contact? And the perspective being, she does not define Hawaiians in relation to non-Hawaiians. She defines Hawaiians as Hawaiians in relation to themselves and their own history and their own experience in the real context. Which is just, it opens up a whole new world, right? And not only a whole new world, but the real world. That's what it is. And it's just such a gift that someone, and she writes, you know, I know my culture, I know psychiatry, I know psychology, I know anthropology, and that's what Malo and Kamakau, who, although they lived under the Kapu system, and they definitely knew it, they did not know. She can speak in more modern terms that makes it more accessible. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just encourage everybody, man, devour that thing. And then always fact check. Be humble in your mana'o and what you learn. Because like we know, you know, Malo in 1835 is writing, a lot of the old timers are gone. Right. And what we know is kind of, you know, watch out your na'o. It can be deceptive. And Mary Kawenapuhui presents that way in the traditional Hawaiian sense, which is not magical, not mystical, not supernatural. It's scientific. And there's so many more nuances and ideas that she throws out that are just like, geez, she's talking about, like, she describes Hawaiians identifying Turing patterns, which are attributed to Alan Turing, who invented the computers, right, in the 20th century.
Yeah.
So it's amazing.
Ahead of her time. Ahead of her time.
And I think that carries us, and it makes Hawaiians more comfortable in the modern world and the issues that we deal with by saying this is not foreign. You know, we've been looking at it this way the whole time. We just didn't have language and math, but we have these olelo and mo'olelo and all this stuff that convey these complex, what can be called scientific ideas nowadays, in a way that can be passed on without written word, which is wild. I mean, recognizing complex mathematics before you had math is amazing, right?
Yeah, and to apply that to today, to what started this series in the first place, this program in the first place, development today, and how we can relate to using the knowledge of then and process and how. More about the how than the what. The recent lawsuit in Princeville over anthrax was, you know, for me, and you told me too on the phone, it's not hearsay, it's allowable information, if not pure evidence, but allowable information in court when I say, but we all knew, it was common knowledge. And Judge Watanabe got it right away and said, you know, that is not hearsay. There is a rule that protects what we say we all knew. And the fact that there was and is anthrax there was not some recent scientific discovery. I knew for 30 years because I was told. And I believe the people that told me because they were there at the time. And so I didn't know exactly where it was, but I knew it existed. And so when the attorneys cross-examined me and said, you know, but how did you know? And I said, it was common knowledge. It was something the community discussed openly. We weren't afraid of it. We knew, you know, it was covered in dirt and there it was. And nobody touched. You know, it was a form of kapu, right? We just knew. It was really... Later on during the trial, I could, because nobody in this world in this time has ever seen Makala sit that still for that long, and many have commented on that. But I was mesmerized for one thing, but for the other, my brain was whirring, probably audibly, because I kept thinking, this is how it's supposed to be. There's supposed to be an opportunity in today's world when we're thinking about this thing somebody's proposing, this change, and even if it's traffic stuff. What is the common understanding of that place and what that place was for? And does this fit? Because I know very few things for certain in this life, but one thing I know for certain is that if it was supposed to be there, it'll last, and if it wasn't supposed to be there, it'll fail. That's just the way it is. And things happen when they're supposed to happen. I can't explain that, but I know in my nearly 80 years on the planet that that's the way it works, right? So, but try to explain that to the corporate president of Starwood Corporation. Yeah, well, he didn't get it, but he will. They will. Because it will either succeed or it will fail based on its appropriateness. And that's what Mary Kavena Pukui does for me personally. Certainly in Olelo no Eawa, but in some of her other work, it she tells me, or she gives me a way to find, to learn, to identify what was supposed to be or what is supposed to be. And then I'm, you know, intelligent human being. I can make the decision whether I want to proceed that way or not. And that's what I think what life is about. And although I appreciate Margaret Mead's work, I use her as a comparison here because she was not looking at her own place. She was not studying a place she knew. She was listening to people that have an amazing sense of humor. If you've ever been with a group of Samoans in any kind of celebration or any kind of event, the one thing they have is a sense of humor. And they're tricky with it, right? I think Hawaiians are too. And took advantage of the moment because somebody asked him, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, I get to tell a story, you know, that kind of thing. and I think that's true in today's world in development. Mana's obviously involved in a lot of different aspects of development life these days. And you know when it's gonna work, right? You know when the proposal fits the place, yeah. That's kind of what you get from these people, the ability to think and observe and listen. So I mean, you know if the proposal fits the place. To me, that's the difference between Pilikia or Pono. If you're proposing something, does the proposal fit the place? We just had that happen here on the island in Kapa. With the old food land, where they said, oh, they want to make storage. And then they wanted to build this extra building that was going to be three stories high. And the people said, no, you can have that one that fits there because it's been there. But you can't have that. That's huge. It doesn't fit the place, right? We have all kinds of planning ordinances and laws and stuff to protect that. But essentially, it didn't fit the place. And the other thing about that is the place fitting you? Is this the place for you at this point? Are you able to participate, contribute, or at least listen and learn? I think that would be a good thing. Probably a really good thing for me to do periodically throughout my life. Am I supposed to really be doing this? But anyway, that's part of what I get from Mary Kovena Pukui, because she did, as we say, she did the work. She didn't dream it up. Therefore, she becomes a really good reference and a really good source. So that's the end of my wisdom for today. Mana, what have you got? Sorry, poor Mana. I think all sympathy cards are appreciated. You can just send them to kkcr.org. Poor Mana.
I just
along for the ride. I'm just along for the ride.
Yeah, I just have so much aloha for her and her work, and just I think it's very it's very timely.
Yeah,
and it's something that we should all look at. I think that the current state of the community and the Native Hawaiian issues and movement is it's changing, right? It's evolving to the next generation. So the kupuna, the people who are actually there doing work at the Hawaiian Renaissance, are passing on. And then it's my generation now that's taking it up. And, you know, what are we going to do with it? How are we going to approach it? Are we going to embrace the real culture and look to our predecessors and what they said and what they did and try to find the truth, like Kamakau was trying to, like Pukui was trying to, like Mala was trying to, and try to present and preserve that? Because that's, you know, you talked about the tsunami in the beginning. There's so much Ike out there in our chants and that can inform that in order to make a better life, right? This is not about politics. This is not about emotions. This is not about ego. It's about a better life for all. I mean, you cannot, recently there was an article in Civil Beat, can settlers ever be accepted? Of course. What are you talking about? Mary Kovena Pukui's dad was from Salem, Massachusetts. John Young was the grandfather of Queen Emma. Like, Pele was an Akua Malihini. They called her a foreign god because she came after Hawaii was populated by the descendants of Papa and Wakea. You can't say that haoles don't belong. Look at the kolea. You said the kolea every year. They're transient visitors. They come and go, you know? And so that's the history of Hawaii, man. Look at the beaches. Driftwood comes up. Driftwood goes away. Some they stay and plant and grow. Some don't. Hey, that's it.
I have the most fun with the malihini and hanale when a whole load of stuff comes down the river in a big flood. And it pushes back and it ends up on the beach and they organize these big group things and they da 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 da. They make big piles of driftwood and then the county comes down and picks it up and puts it God knows where. It's probably in our landfill, and I go down and just laugh. I mean, what are you doing? You know, the stuff comes, the stuff goes. It's you know, leave it. It's coming. Yeah. You know, it'll dissolve.
Yeah, getting move it. You don't want anyone to get hurt. You can play stick fight. You know what I mean? Like, whatever. But as far as trying to control it, you're right. I think that there is much to be learned still. And she is so good and so accessible because she speaks how we talk, right? And she really does bridge everything. So much aloha to her, so much aloha to her family. And her family, like, for example, and they don't invent tradition. I think that's what I love most about it. The Suganumas have a blog, or they did. I'm not sure if they're keeping up. I haven't read it in a while. But they had such a great article about, and it was fair criticism about invented tradition and the fact that the Hokulea, their Aba ceremony wasn't Hawaiian. It was Southern Polynesian. And they even got as detailed as to say that, you know, they cut the coconut wrong. If you get a coconut, you know, it's got two pointy sides. And if you cut it if you put those pointy sides at the pole and you cut it at the equator, it doesn't stand up, but it's circular. It's more circular and looks more like a cup. But if you put it on its side, so the points are sticking out, and you cut it lengthwise, it's not a cup, it's an oval, but it sits. You can put it down. And they write about how Hawaiians didn't share ava cups. they had their own.
Yes.
Because Hawaiian culture was, you didn't share your clothes, that had your mana in it. And you would not dare take someone else's, and you definitely wouldn't touch a chief's. And then I was like, wow. Because you think Hokulea, they should know everything, right? No, not necessarily. So I immediately cut a coconut shell to make it like a real Ava cup, and it was exactly correct. Every other Ava ceremony I've been to, it tilts. And I was like, dang. And it made me feel so good, not because I want to denigrate Hokulea, because obviously they're awesome, but the fact we all have stuff to learn, and we all have stuff we can teach each other. And I think that brings us together as a community, and the openness to not only our concepts and our ideas, but to others.
Yeah.
It's not going to get caught in who's an immigrant. The immigrant discussion is silly. The Nanala chiefs came before the Pili chiefs. They both came after the Manahune, and all this kind of stuff, man. Like, what are we trying to do here? I propose that we're here to give a better life, to live on these remote, barren islands that need all the human energy and ingenuity we have to live, because otherwise we don't live here. I mean, from where the Hawaiians set foot here, they started consuming endemic species, right? We started terraforming the earth. We started diverting water. We started doing all this stuff in a way that we needed to. And I'm not saying bad development is good. I'm saying good development is necessary, right? Because that's what the Hawaiians did. And so I think that's where we need to go when we face these modern problems like housing and traffic and everything, which, if you look in the historical record, aren't modern problems. They are the problems of living in Hawaii. So let's give money to the radio. Let's talk about what's Pili Chi and what's Pono. And imua, man, let's go forward.
Oh, man, perfect, Mauna. Perfect, perfect, perfect. This is where I'm saying in my head, Makala, shut up. Yes, 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 yes. So please mahalo the fact that we have this opportunity, that we have this place to have this conversation. And you can tell it is that. It's a conversation. This is Pilikia Oponoan with Mauna Kea Trask and myself, Maka'ale, and it's the second Wednesday of every month. And we mahalo Laura Christine for waking up early and getting here with me, because a stubborn old lady refuses to learn how to operate the buttons. And we thank Mauna, although I have to tell you, he's up at, 4:30 or something anyway, so it's nothing for him. But thank you, Mauna, for doing it. Thank you, Laura, for doing it. And thank you, KKCR, for existing. And this is the time, folks. If you have never contributed before, this is the time. We're 20% down. It's a fact. It's not a promotional jargon. It is the truth. And so please, whatever you can do. And the easiest way that I've found is to do something as a sustaining member. Do something monthly. It's easy. It's painless. Auto-pay. Auto-pay is man, I'm so happy about auto-pay. Go to kkcr.org, please, and press the donate button, and you'll see the options there. Mahalo, Mauna. We will see you next month, second Wednesday of every month. Aloha.
Aloha. Aloha, Aaron. Have a good day.
You too.
She can give, defend the birthright to be free, give our children.